is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We always try to identify is what skill sets did every coach on staff have, and let them really own those skill sets. And so if we had a coach on staff who was great at player development, he became the head coach of player development.
Matt McLeod was a head coach in Texas and Oklahoma high schools for 14 years, where he amassed 324 total wins and was recognized three times as the Texas Outstanding Coach of the Year by the Texas Association of Basketball Coaches. Matt stepped away from coaching his own team after the 2020-2021 season to offer an array of coaching services through Matt McLeod Basketball to help athletes, coaches, and parents at a deeper and more personal level all across the world. Matt spent the last 4 years of his coaching career as the head coach at Cassidy High School in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. In 4 years, the program amassed 82 total wins, including a 742 winning percentage over his final three seasons on the bench. Prior to moving to the Sooner State, Matt had spent 10 years as a head coach in Texas. His last two seasons in Texas were spent at the Covenant Preparatory School in Kingwood, Texas, where the program amassed a record of 62-15, including a district championship and a 2016-17 Final Four appearance. Matt also spends time assisting basketball athletes and coaches all over the United States through his work with both Savvy Basketball and PGC Basketball. Hey, Hoopheads, transform your training this April with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get $1,500 off any new machine in the month of April. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdish.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Clint Pulver, the author of I Love It Here, and you are listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram. And be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com. Be sure to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Matt McLeod. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Coach Matt McLeod. Matt, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Man, appreciate it. Thanks for having me tonight. Really excited to have our conversation.
looking forward to diving in with you, getting a chance to check out all the great things that you've been able to do over the course of your coaching career. Let's start, though, by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, Mike, I would say that my life forever changed when I was 6 years old and I moved from Western New York down to Raleigh, North Carolina. And so then growing up basically on Tobacco Road, you have no choice but to love basketball. And so even going back to then, I'll never forget, within a couple of days, I decided I was a Duke fan and not a Carolina fan. And, you know, we can fight over all that later. But I just grew up around the game, loving the game. Whether it was playing it or even coaching it, when I was in middle school, I'd start coaching my younger brother's elementary school teams. There was just something inside me that attached to the game of basketball early on, and it's been a part of my life ever since.
Not NC State?
You know, everybody can be a State fan. So I have a great appreciation for the Wolfpack, always cheer for them. But yeah, I grew up diehard Dukie, you know, like every other boy growing up in North Carolina, was convinced Coach K one day was going to show up and offer me a scholarship. That never happened, but it was okay. I wasn't a Duke level player at all.
You figured it out eventually, right?
Eventually. Actually, he was at one of my high school games. So this was back. I'm a older guy, graduated in the late 90s. And my junior year of high school, we walked into the gym. Second quarter of the girls' game, and there is Coach K sitting in the stands. And so, of course, for the next 20 minutes, my teammates and I are all arguing over who he's there to watch, because obviously it's one of us, right? Like, unannounced,
right,
he's there to watch us, yeah. And then as our game was tipping off and we were all excited to have Coach K watch us play, he picked up his stuff and walked out before the game even tipped off. Well, little did we know that his daughter was going to the opposing school. And so he was there for the girls' game and then got out right afterwards. But got that close to Coach K seeing me in person one time.
Nice. It's funny how back in the day, how uninformed we all were about the recruiting process and what was actually going on. Because nowadays you think about how public everything is with kids saying this and that on Twitter and on Instagram and all the posts and just information that's out there. Whereas back in the late 90s or in the late 80s when I would have been in high school, man, it's just there, that stuff was not around at all. And you had no idea what was going on.
No idea whatsoever. And the cool thing was all the parents there at the school let Coach K be a dad that night. So I'll never forget that experience. But yeah, you are so right. Things are so different now than they were then. We just thought that undiscovered gem had happened that night in Durham, North Carolina.
What's your favorite memory of playing high school basketball?
Favorite memory would just have to be the competition. I was at a school that was not really a basketball school, so to speak, more of a football school, baseball school. And we had a run early till the late in my high school career. We had a lot of success. And even, you know, actually, I'll never forget my junior year, we beat a team that we had not beat in 20 years. And so just having that moment, that feeling of doing something that, you know, has not been done a long time. People thought you couldn't do. I mean, we were big time underdogs. We had no Division I players. They had multiple D1 players on their team. And I really do think that going back to that night was one thing that really inspired me to coach and to give that same moment, that same opportunities to the players I was around, to the players I was coaching. And I'll just never forget that moment, that night, winning that game, top of the world. Nothing could mess up my day the next day, you know? And I just think those are the moments that we all hold on to as coaches and players. And that's why even when we take those tough losses and have the disappointing seasons, we keep fighting through it to find more moments like that.
Yeah, when you get a special moment like that, especially from a high school standpoint, when you have guys that you've probably known your entire life that you get an opportunity to play with, and then you get to share one of those moments. There's nothing like that. I think it's really hard to top, again, just because of the connection that you end up having with your high school teammates. You talked a little bit about how you started out coaching and you were coaching at the younger levels. And when you talk about that coaching bug, when did you feel like you first said, ooh, I think this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. I think this is really where I want to spend my time. When do you remember that kind of crystallizing for you?
You know, I remember throughout high school really feeling strong that I wanted to be a coach, you know, get into it, do those things and impact the game in so many ways. I mean, again, growing up in North Carolina, whether it's the Division I level, Division II level, high school level, there's incredible coaches all over the place that I got to just be around, experience, pseudo learn from. But then again, just like so many of us, got to college and said, oh, I want to chase the dollar signs. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a doctor. Maybe I want to do something different. And so then, you know, throughout college really hadn't, pursued it as much or thought about as much. But after I was out of college for about a year, there was just this piece of me that didn't feel fulfilled. And at the time, I was working in college athletics, but not coaching. I was working more in the media relations, sports information side. And so it was awesome. I got to travel the country, travel out of the country with teams and cover them. And it was having a lot of fun, but just felt like something was missing. And so actually had, at the time, my wife and I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we kind of had a conversation in October of that year, like, hey, when this school year's done, let's just move back to North Carolina. My wife's a teacher. We're like, you know, I'm sure she can find a job somewhere. The only people I really knew in the coaching world at the high school level were in North Carolina. So let's go back. Let's do that. And little do we know that about 2.5 weeks later, I was going to get a phone call from a school way down in Victoria, Texas. I actually had to look it up on the map the first time because I didn't know where it was. But it's about 2 hours southwest of Houston going down towards Corpus Christi. And it was one of those friend of a friend of a friend kind of deals. And they had their athletic director walk out on them in the middle of the school year. And I got a phone call that said, hey, heard you were interested in getting into the high school athletic side. Wondering if you're interested in coming down and interviewing. And so obviously, yes, next flight out, let me come down there. Let me see what's going on. And I just had the really awesome opportunity at 25 years old to be an athletic director and take over the basketball team there at a high school in Victoria, Texas.
Did you feel like you were ready in any way, shape, or form? Or was it more a case of you didn't know what you didn't know?
It was definitely, I didn't know what I didn't know. I thought I was ready. And actually walked into a situation where had one super talented player. And the team had not had much success the year before I got there. It was an interesting situation. I got there in January and did not coach the team the rest of that season. I was going to take over the next year. And so they'd really struggled that year. And but had one phenomenal all-state level player. And so we made a couple of changes. I think, you know, I'm sure your experience as a coach was similar. That first year as a head coach, and again, I had no assistant coaching experience outside of being a manager when I was in college, but just stepped in and said, you know what? I want to play the way my coach never let us play. And when I was growing up, it was always multiple post touches, never possession. We ran the flex offense. We were just going to grind that game into the low 40s. And so we began just to pick up the pace and play with a little bit of pace and space and speed. And I was like, shoot, we won less than a third of our games last year. What's the worst that could happen? And we kind of stumbled onto something there and found some success early on, even that first season going all the way to the regional finals. We got a buzzer beater hit on us that kept us from going to the Final Four. And so, unfortunately, that early success as a coach, at that point in time, I thought I knew everything. And so we had a great couple of years. And then when the talent left, I learned it definitely is the Jimmys and Joes that makes us as a coach sometimes. And so that's when I think that about fourth year in coaching is when I really, really buckled in and learned what it meant to be a coach and to build a program, regardless of what players we may or may not have in any given year.
When you look back at your start, and I can completely relate to what you just said about thinking that you knew everything. When I got my first coaching job, I was 25 years old. I was a head JV coach. And just like you, I had no assistants. And I walked in there thinking that I knew pretty much everything about the game. I had been a good player. I thought, well, that automatically makes me a good coach. And
absolutely.
So I went through and you look back on it, you're like, oh God, I was terrible. I didn't know anything about what I was doing. But I do know that there was one or two things that I was pretty good at. So when you think back to that time when you get your first coaching job, what's something that even retrospectively, when you look back, you say, even though I made a lot of mistakes or even though I didn't do this very well, what's something that you feel like you were pretty good at right out of the gate as a coach?
Yeah, there are two things that I really stumbled onto early in my coaching career that I'm so glad I did, because I was able to continue to develop those things and really make it the foundation of who I've been as a coach over all these years. And the first thing was relationships. And I'm sure you had a similar experience. I mean, when I'm 25 and they're 16, 17, 18, there's not that big of an age gap. And so was able to find some great ways to connect with the players, to have relationships with them off the floor as well as on the floor. I mean, my wife and I had only been married for about a year, year and a half. And so, man, every weekend at my house, we were having 2K tournaments. You know, we were hanging out, and I just wanted to be around them and build that, because we knew nobody where we were living. And so we just dove all in with building player relationships. And that was something that, so when we had tough days in practice, when we were having tough halves, and I was really having to hold us accountable on certain things, we had that bedrock of a relationship. And so they knew how much I cared about them. And it wasn't just me yelling and screaming for no reason. So that was one thing early in my coaching career, I think, saved me from a lot of headache, was those relationships I had. And I would say the second thing was player development. I walked into a situation, like I said, we did not have a lot of natural talent. And so we spent that first off season together, and even going into the season, it was not about running plays. It was not about sets. It was like, we have to be able to not turn the ball over when we get across half court. We have to be able to make sure we can get stops and have some positional awareness on defense. And really the growth I saw in my team that first year kept me going down that road where it was less and less about how smart I was as a coach, but how well could I develop my players, not just with their skill sets, but also with their decision making. And after that first year, again, we'd had so much success in year one, we just rolled it over to year two and then rolled it over to year three. And I think those are two things for sure that every coach that now that I mentor, that I work with, or friends who are going through, you know, new situations, or if I've taken over new programs, it's build relationships and build their skill set and their decision making. I think those are great things for us to do as coaches.
All right, so let's talk about the helping them improve their decision-making on the floor. The relationship piece of it, I get completely where you're coming from with that in terms of being able to connect and get those kids to know and understand that you care about them more as people and not just as basketball players, and that allows you to coach them harder and get more out of them. But let's talk about the other piece of trying to build better decision-makers out on the floor. So when you take over a program, and obviously the program has been losing, you have some basketball things that you got to work on. And so if you're going to work on basketball IQ, you're going to work on basketball decision-making, what does that look like for you? How do you go about developing that? Maybe give us one or two things that you focus on, or just how you align your practices. What is it that you do to help players improve that on-court decision-making?
Yeah, I'd say the first thing, Mike, for sure, is shooting. You know, we have the best X's and O's in the world, but at the end of that possession, if the ball doesn't go in the basket, it doesn't really matter. And so, you know, and again, just a byproduct of my first head coaching job being in South Texas, we were heavily, heavily Hispanic. I think in the 3 years I was there, we had one guy who was taller than 6'2 or 6'3. And so we were short, we were quick. A lot of my guys had grown up playing soccer, just like I had. That's what I played in the offseason in North Carolina. And so I was like, okay, well, how can we turn what they know and understand into what's going to be successful on the court? And so I was like, well, if we don't make shots, we're not going to win games. And so really putting a huge emphasis on shooting and being able to, you know, force the defense to actually guard the width of the floor and force the defense to guard at and past the three-point line. That was one thing that for us always, and for any program, I think that's if you want to be successful on offense, especially in today's game, if any kind of zero shooter or negative shooter on the floor, it's really going to impact your offense. So we spent a lot of time with that. And then when it came specifically to basketball IQ, we really focused on a three-step process. And so the first thing was that baseline skill development. I mean, it's really hard to make decisions if you can't keep your eyes up while you're dribbling with a pressure defense on you, right? Like no earth-shattering news there. But we just had to start at the foundational level with reps. Like we're going to rep out and rep out and rep out whatever skill it is that we're working on till we get to a pretty proficient level. For us, a big thing that we love to teach as our players are attacking the basket is their drive decision. You know, what do I see in front of me as the defense rotates? And then if we rep out what we need to do, then we have to start making reads. And so what we would do in our practices is first we'd rep out, okay, an open rim, or if you only get a shoulder an arm in front of you, what do you do? Then we would rep out, okay, great, now you see chest of that rotating help side defender. When you see chest, what's your decision? We called it chest and shoulder reads. So after we rep it out and they begin to understand, then we go into the reads, where now the defense is giving you one or the other. And now can we connect the dots? You know, I heard JJ Redick talking on his podcast one time how the light really went on for him in the NBA when he realized, man, these teams are only running like five or six different actions. They just call it different things. And now it becomes a game of memorization. When I see this, I do that. And so that's what we try to build out with our reads. And then we go real. Hey, can we, now we've done it in a rep situation where the defense is completely static. Now we've done it in a binary decision-making read. So now we go real. Can we do those same things and replicate them? And I think that's one thing in our practices that we built out, that we'd always have a minimum of 30 minutes of shooting, you know, coach speak, game shots, game spots, game speed. And then we would go 30 minutes of player development, which was some combination of skill set and decision making. And, you know, if there were multiple field trips and an assembly and we only had an hour of practice, that was our hour of practice. And again, because that was our foundation, that was our bedrock. No matter what else we did, we were going to shoot and we were going to work on our player development.
How do you approach interjecting coaching into those players making decisions. In other words, when a player goes and let's say you're doing a small-sided game of 3-on-3 or you're in a 5-on-5 scrimmage situation and a kid makes a read that's an incorrect read for whatever. Again, this could be anything. But
yeah,
when that happens, how much do you balance, hey, I stop it and I explain to the kid, here's what you should have seen, or I ask a question, or just how much do you let it flow and then talk about it at the end? Just talk about your style in terms of how you get kids to understand what the best read is without completely interrupting the flow of practice and the action.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say early in my coaching career, I did a terrible job of that. We were stopping practice all the time. Every little individual decision that was wrong, we would stop and try to fix. And then I just realized, because again, we were every place that I've been, we've really wanted to focus on having a faster tempo than what most of our opponents were used to. And so I just realized if I kept stopping practice all the time, that was building a disconnect with our team over what we wanted to see happen in games. And so we really try to use small-sided games, lots of 2-on-2 and 3-on-3, to build that decision-making so that when mistakes happen, when the wrong read happens, number one, we tell our players, if you're going to make the wrong decision, make it at full speed. Don't be hesitant, because sometimes the wrong decision can still work out okay if we're going hard and giving great effort and doing all the things that we're supposed to do. But then I think that one of the great benefits of going with a lot of small-sided action in practice is now our players are off the floor and getting a little bit of rest and recovery and even watching their teammates go through decision making. So that's where then we as our coaching staff would always have one person on the baseline asking questions. Why did you make that read? Even if it was the right read, sometimes we would still ask the same thing, which is we want to be very question based. I do think on one level players should do it because their coach says so. I mean, that's yes, we're a positional leader. But if they only do it because we say so, we're missing out as coaches. And so I want players to know that I wanted them to learn. I want them to have autonomy in the things that they were doing. And so if we could kind of walk them down that path and they discover it, you know, on their own with their own words, I thought that was where the really special things happen. And then anytime we play 5-on-5, I would love to say we never stopped the action when it was full court 5-on-5, but that would be the goal. Because again, for us, we didn't want the play to stop very often. We wanted the other team to be calling timeouts in the first half, not us. And so we would try to replicate that as much as possible in our practices.
So let's say you are going 5-on-5 in a practice setting and you're going up and down and you see something that you know that you want to speak to one of the players about a decision, a read, something that you saw. How do you go about, if you're not going to try to stop the action, is that something that you might pull the player aside over the next water break and say, hey, you remember play X, Y, or Z? Is that something where they might sub out a minute or two later and then an assistant coach grabs them and talks about that? Just how do you approach it? Because we all know, look, I've said this a couple times on the podcast, my first coaching experience as that JV head coach, I came into that first practice and I watched 5 minutes of the first drill and I was completely and utterly overwhelmed. I'm like, there was just 500 things that were done incorrectly and I have no idea how I'm going to coach all these different things. I remember coming home after that first practice, Matt, and being like, oh my God, like I don't even know where to begin. How do I narrow this down into what I can do and what I can say and how I can try to fix this stuff? So just how do you approach like in a 5-on-5 situation? If there's something you know, like, man, I've been working with this player on this decision and they just made that decision incorrectly. How do you go about making sure that you get the information that player needs to be able to start to see and recognize what the better decision was?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm just glad to know, Mike, that I'm not the only one that felt that way after the first practice. Cause I remember too thinking like, how much time can I practice every week? Like we need to be in the gym like 8 hours a day after school to fix everything that's wrong. So I'm glad you had a similar experience. I'm not there by myself. I would say that, you know, when we're going like that, to us, again, we wanted that time. We want our practices to replicate games as much as possible. And so that's where, in game situations as a coach, we only have 5 timeouts. But we do have, like you mentioned, subbing opportunities, free throw opportunities, maybe a dead ball opportunity. And so that's what we would focus on doing. I'm a consummate note taker. Like I always have some kind of notebook in my pocket with a pen. And so we'll just be writing down those things again that were those glaring issues or glaring spots. And also I think sometimes as coaches, we can get, or at least speaking for myself, I can get way too locked in on a single decision. Let's say that player might've had the same decision 5 times in a 5-on-5 situation. Well, if he makes the wrong decision the first time, but if he adjusts on his own and makes the right decision the next 3 times or 4 times, there was no need for me to stop it. And so that's where I think, you know, I found a lot of success letting go of the individual moments and zooming out in those situations, taking notes, pulling players aside during water breaks, subbing them out, or maybe during a free throw situation, having them come over to the sideline real quick and give them a quick reminder. But as the action was going on, and again, no coach is perfect. I failed many times at this, but we would really focus on doubling down on the correct decisions and just really letting that be what the players heard coming from our mouths while they were going up and down the floor. And just celebrate the wins, celebrate the great stuff. And then, hey, next water break, next, you know, when this play is done, when this segment, this 5-minute drill is done, then let's have this conversation before we move on.
How much do you use film to do some of that same stuff? So whether or not, obviously at the high school level, you may or may not have the opportunity to film practices and you don't have as much time as a college coach to be able to sit and watch every single practice and go back to it. But just think about it from a game perspective. How do you approach the balance between pointing out positives, which you just talked about, which is what you try to do, and then you kind of call a player over to the side. It's more of a one-on-one thing where you say, hey, I noticed this. I'd like to see you do more of X or less of Y. Just how do you approach that in a film session?
Yeah, I think film is an important component of practice every single day. Not hour-long film sessions. I can't even keep my own attention for an hour in a film session. But what we were, you know, in overtime, man, it's coaching in, you know, 2022 versus coaching in 2005 is a big difference. And so the access to things is incredible. And probably about, I'd say probably 8 or 9 years ago, it just kind of clicked for me. Hey, you've got a camera in your pocket at all times. And so really even just pulling my phone out and filming 30 seconds of a drill or filming the action up and down the floor as certain decisions are being made. And then that, I think that water break's a great time just to pull the phone out and say, hey, watch this. Tell me what you think. Or we would try to also get into situations where maybe we had three teams of five. And while two teams are going up and down the floor, that third team that just got off the floor is reviewing some film with a coach, whether it's on an iPad, on a phone. Last couple of years, we had a TV in the gym with us while we were practicing. And so we would just, you know, Bluetooth it up there and watch. And I think that's something that's really, really key. You know, one thing that I'm really glad I started to do as a coach for the last 3 or 4 years when I was still coaching high school basketball is we started out every practice with 6 to 8 minutes of film. And it was either, you know, maybe highlights from the night before if we'd had a big win. If we had a big rivalry game coming up, it was maybe whatever action that the other team was really good at and watching it and breaking it down. Or some days, if we just need a little pick-me-up, maybe it was a motivational video of some sort. But we would always spend that first 6 or 8 minutes in the gym, around the TV, watching some type of film. And then, so it built the culture of expecting to watch film. And I just think that's powerful for all of us as coaches. Going back and even watching some film now of some previous seasons, I just remember, like, what was I thinking as a coach? Like, why did I not call timeout there? Why did we change our defense? It was working really well before. And so I think as much as we want our players to watch film, we as coaches, we need to hold ourselves accountable and watch film and grade it ourselves as well.
That's very true that you can watch and look and see. And so often, I think as coaches, we're focused on player X doing this, player Y doing that. And we sometimes forget or don't analyze our own performance, whether that comes to X and O decisions, substitution decisions, like timeout decisions. I think one of the things that if you watch basketball all the time, I think one of the things that, at least for me, that I'll find myself watching a game and one of the biggest things that always jumps out at me is, and again, it's a lot easier sitting on your TV or sitting up in the stands to understand when it is to call a timeout. But you watch some of these things, you're like, what? Like, why didn't you call a timeout there? Or why would you call a timeout in that situation? And so I think you're right that to be able to self-evaluate, to use that film to self-evaluate is really important. And that ability to look at yourself and figure out, hey, what are my strengths and weaknesses? What am I good at? What am I improving? What do I need to continue to improve? I think as coaches, sometimes we get so caught up in trying to help our players get better that we forget that there's an opportunity for us, not only out of season, which we all know that there's, you know, opportunities to grow and develop, and there's lots of ways. It's easier than it's ever been from a coaching standpoint to do that. But I think sometimes in season, right, we forget that we can self-evaluate and try to help not only our players get better, but help ourselves get better. And film's a great way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one thing, and I know, I think so often as coaches, we probably, it's generational in coaching, right? Like we do what our coaches did to begin with, and our coaches did what their coaches did, and it just keeps going back. And one thing for me that really, man, made me so much better as a coach is when I started allowing key players on the team to give me feedback from practices and games. Hey, what do you think about how I'm doing as a coach? What do you think when I called this timeout, or when I didn't call that timeout, or when I changed our defenses? I mean, I think one thing that sometimes we forget a little too quickly as coaches is that when you're playing the game, it looks and feels a lot different than when you're standing on the sideline coaching. And so being able to have players who care about the team and care about their teammates and care about winning and all the things that we want them to care about as coaches, well, we should invest enough in those players to let them have that open feedback with us. And we talk about with our program, it's always three things: right time, right place, right attitude. But if it was the right time, the right place, and you had the right attitude, there was nothing you could not talk about or bring up or say to us as coaches. Because then it became us together versus coaches and players in these separate bubbles we were living in. And I just think that's one thing for me as a coach that really, really helped me level up and our teams to be able to get through things that would have been tough to get through otherwise.
What's something, either a specific or maybe just a general theme, something that you learned from those conversations, whether it's, again, a particular incident or maybe just an overarching theme that runs through the responses that you got from players in those kinds of situations?
No, for sure. One thing that we've always done with our programs during the summer is really the players coach themselves. Even, you know, I know every state's a little different at the high school level, what the rules are, who can coach in the summer. But the coaching in Texas and Oklahoma, both states, I would have been able to coach them in the summer with the leagues that I coached in. But really, part of it is I wanted a break from them. And I thought they also deserved a break from me. And so would, you know, whether it's getting a former player from our program, you know, a parent that we could really trust. But really in the summer, the person on the sideline, all they were doing was really just overseeing subbing and making sure that guys got into the game. Besides that, I wanted my players to call the offense, call the defense, let them really experience what it was like to be the coach on the floor. And there was one time about 4 years ago where we had a new player coming in. He was going to be a sophomore for us and was definitely going to be a starter on our varsity, ended up being our leading scorer that year. And this was a very new situation for him. He was used to being more micromanaged when he was on the court, even during the summer. And so there was the first summer league game we played. All of a sudden we were losing a team we probably shouldn't have been losing to, but whatever, it's the summer. And he comes over to me right before I'm like, "Coach, like, why are we still playing man defense?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, man's our traditional defense, but PJ, I really don't know why we're running man defense, because I don't call the defense in the summer." He's like, "What?" I was like, "No, remember before the game started, we talked about it." He's like, "Yeah, but like, I didn't think you really meant it." He's like, "I thought when we got in the game, you just started telling us what to do." And I was like, "No, for real. Like, I think you guys probably should have, you know, either changed your pick and roll coverage or maybe do something a little different, go to a matchup or something. But you guys do whatever you want to do. It's the summer. It's your time to experiment." And so he went out there, got the team together and started talking about making changes and things. But what I realized in that conversation with him is I hadn't done a good enough job explaining why. And so many conversations with players have opened my eyes to, I might understand it as a coach because I understand it. That's the way I see the world. And that's the filter that I see through my coaching lens. But if I don't give my players a great why, it doesn't matter. You know, I could have let those guys call their own offense and defense the whole summer, but if I had never connected the dots for PJ, it would have been a wasted exercise. But being able to say, "Hey guys, listen, I want you to be able to see certain things on the floor, come over to me with suggestions and ideas of how to change it." I think that's how we can have the best relationship and the best team moving forward. And so it was a great conversation he and I had that night. And, you know, moving forward, man, now they understood, hey, when coach says, "Let's make a change," he really means it. He sees something specific versus, "I just change the defense or change the offense just because I feel like it." So those are definitely very big eye-opening experiences for me, making sure I was always given the why during those conversations.
I like the idea of giving the players that freedom or that responsibility in the summertime, because one of the things that you hear coaches talk about a lot, we've had plenty of conversations on the podcast with different people about this, where a coach, one of the things that they want to do is develop leaders within their program. And so you talk about, well, how do I develop leaders during the season? And what is it that I'm going to do? And what's the value of somebody being a captain? And how do we go about making sure that we don't just have one kid leading, but everybody has responsibility to lead? And it's a topic of conversation that I know you've been involved in many conversations about it, and so have I. And it's something that coaches are always looking to do. So to me, this makes a lot of sense when I think about, okay, if I step back in the summertime as a coach and I put that responsibility on the players, and especially coming off of building that relationship during the season and getting them to understand what your expectations are and all those things as you're starting to put your program together. Now, once the players have that handle on it and they can do that in the summertime, now when you come back to the season and you're asking for players to be leaders, or you're having them take responsibility, take accountability for what's going on out on the floor, that suddenly becomes a lot easier because they have some experience in what oftentimes is lower stakes, right? You're playing in a summer league. Yep. There's not the same stakes. People aren't in the stands. The record's not going on anybody's. Nobody's keeping track of your stats. You're just going out there and you're playing and trying to get better. And so it makes a ton of sense to me to be able to give that responsibility to players in the summertime. And now I'm sure you see the benefits of that when they come back to you in the season, because now you've actually given them a chance to develop those leadership skills. I think so often we talk about, hey, our team doesn't have any leaders, or hey, we need more leaders on the team. But we as coaches, I think, sometimes fail to give kids an opportunity to lead. And to me, this is a great way to give kids an opportunity to lead in a slightly lower stakes environment.
Yeah, you know, just as far as getting finding ways that players can lead during those low stakes times, I think is something that really helped, you know, me find success as a coach. And really, even early on in the process, I don't even think I realized how beneficial it was. But those summer, even during summer sessions and skills workouts, of having players maybe lead the workout that we had written down as coaches, or really, I always set a goal anytime we're at a new location, a new place, taking over a program, by the end of that first summer, or a minimum going into summer number two, players would be responsible for coming up with workouts, where maybe Dillard is in charge of the 15 to 20 minute shooting segment if we have a 60 minute workout. And then, you know, Jackson's in charge for the 20 minutes of ball handling. And then DJ's in charge of the 20 minutes of live action and how we're going to play those games and what the point system is going to look like. And I think it's really giving players opportunities to lead as much as possible. And I think we all as coaches can do a better job of that in the offseason. I would even challenge coaches to do that during the season. I know sometimes it's hard for us to let go of control in season when the records matter and the lights are on and the real jerseys are being worn. But we would always look for ways to let players make decisions throughout the course of practices, throughout the course of games, throughout the course of even planning for the next opponent. I'll never forget one year when I took over at a new program, and we were going, it was year two there, and we were coming back from Christmas, and that first practice after Christmas was big because we were about 3 days away from playing the big crosstown rival. It was a non-league game, but it mattered probably the most, and I was feeling that pressure as a coach to make sure we're gonna be successful that night. And it was actually that same player I was talking about earlier, PJ, who is, you know, his first summer with us was being able to experiment with what it meant to call his own defense while he was playing and have conversations with teammates about coverages and things. And we walked in, and I'll never forget, because we had 3 days of practice, I had my whole speech ready, and Mike, and we walked into the room. I was like, okay guys, day one today is about knocking the rust off. We're gonna have a little extra time where we're making sure we're getting up and down the floor, making sure we're all in great shape. We want to be able to play at speed. You know, tomorrow we'll work a little more into our opponent, and then day three we'll really be fully focused on our opponent, getting ready for Friday night's game. And PJ said, well coach, you don't have to worry about getting ready for the opponent. I've already done that for you. And I was like, really? What are you talking about? And he laid down a scouting report in front of me. And it didn't surprise me. He was someone who was fully invested in the team and watched nearly as much film as I did as a coach. And he had spent his Christmas break watching and breaking down that opponent. And I really think part of the reason he felt so confident in doing that was because we had given him and his teammates opportunities all throughout the course of the year to take ownership and to look for ways to make it better. And you know what? I flipped through that scouting report that night, Mike, and it was probably 88% of what I would have said. And so we rolled with it. It's like, you know what? 88% from a teammate, they're going to be 100% bought in.
Right,
and
absolutely.
So it was great. We came up a little short, but it was a battle back and forth. And it was not his scouting report that cost us the game. I'm sure it was a couple of decisions I made as a coach or substitution patterns. He had us fully prepared for what we need to do on offense and what we need to do on defense. And so, yeah, just like you mentioned, finding those ways to give players, you know, individual and even group-wide leading opportunities. I think that's transformational for us as coaches and for our programs.
So when you do that with players, obviously it has an impact, but you also have to be able to work with your staff and empower them to be able to have some responsibilities and that obviously, if you can tap into your assistant coach's strengths and get them to the point where they can help to contribute to what you're trying to do as a program, that's when you really can start to get things rolling. And we've talked to numerous coaches who have talked about the fact that when they started, oftentimes as a young coach, like we talked about earlier, where you just feel like you have to have your hand in every single thing. And the idea of giving decisions to players is unbelievably scary. And even giving decisions or responsibilities to assistant coaches is something that a lot of young coaches have a really hard time doing. Because obviously one of the reasons that you're successful is because you have a little bit of an ego, especially if you have a background as a player.
Right.
Your ego is very important. And right, so I think I can be the best at whatever it is that I'm trying to do. And yet we talked to so many coaches, Matt, that have told us when I really started to be successful is when I started to let go of so many more things. And I empowered the people that were part of our program, again, whether that's the players or the coaching staff, to be able to do things. So when you think about how you utilize your staff, when you've been lucky enough to have one, how have you been able to delegate and empower your assistants to be able to do things to help make your program better?
Yeah, you know, Mike, I got some great advice from a mentor when I was in my second or third year as a head coach and was having a similar conversation. Like, you know, how do I best use my assistants? How do I know if I'm doing a good job with them? And one thing he said to me, he said, Matt, if other schools aren't trying to hire your assistants away as head coaches, you're doing something wrong. He said, that should be your goal as a head coach. Your goal as a head coach should be to develop and to, you know, pour into these assistant coaches so that they're ready for their head coaching job. And that really began to change the way I viewed my assistant coaches. And so that was, yeah, for me was the exact same thing as what you're talking about, is when I began to let go of certain responsibilities and really empower my assistants. And I don't think it's a blind empowerment where, you know, a new coach on your staff that you don't know very well and, hey, all right, coach, now you're in charge of the defense from start to finish. Like, no, like we can't just turn everything over without a plan, without some leadership and development and teaching and even coaching our assistant coaches. But that was one thing that we always tried to identify is what skill sets did every coach on staff have and let them really own those skill sets. And so if we had a coach on staff who was great at player development, he became the head coach of player development. And so he and I would have conversations about, okay, these are the things we're looking for. These are the proficiencies that we want to have as a team. And then really being able to turn him loose to figure out what is the best way to get us from where we are now to where we want to go. Or if we had a coach that was super passionate about defense, hey, great. You are our defensive coordinator. You're responsible for watching our opponents, seeing their tendencies, what they do, and coming up with that first round of ideas of the best things for us to do to stop them. And really over the years, that type of relationship rolled into what I had at the last high school, Cassidy High School in Oklahoma City that I was coaching at, where my top assistant coach, he ran all the defense. Like he and I would talk, and I would give him thoughts and ideas, but he loved it. He did such a great job at it. And it really gave me a chance during practice to step back and watch and begin to think and even talk with players and ask them questions. And you know, what do they think about these things they're doing? How is it playing out for them in games versus me, so to speak, having the mic in my hand at all times? I heard Buzz Williams talk one time and he said that, you know, every coach on your staff should be the head coach of something. Maybe it's just one thing. Maybe it's the head coach of travel. They're making sure the bus is scheduled. Gassed up. It's ready to go. But really, I mean, there's rarely an assistant coach that doesn't aspire to be a head coach. And so what can we do as head coaches to really help them level up so they're ready for that first opportunity that they get?
Yeah, that's so important. I think it's something that the longer you're in the profession, the more you realize how much of a responsibility that is as a head coach to be able to develop your assistants into the types of coaches that other programs, as you said, would love to hire and get to be part of their staff. And I think when you're a head coach and you do a good job of that, you're not only helping the assistant coaches, you're not only helping yourself as the head coach because they're taking some of that responsibility, but you're also making it better for your players because they're hearing different voices on different things. And I love what you said about being able to step back and see that big picture. I often equate that to when you think about the adage sort of in the business world where somebody's working, they're always working in their business instead of working on their business. And it's like, I'm doing all this minutia, right? I'm the person who has to balance the books. I'm the person who has to order the, whatever, the widgets. I'm the person who has to do all these little things that really other people could be doing where I could be focused on the bigger picture. And I think sometimes as coaches, we get caught up in such that minutia that we don't ever have a time to take take that deep breath, step back, and really look at, hey, what's going on in the totality of our team, of our program? What are the big picture things that I need to look at? Because we're so focused on that day to day. And when you can give some of that to your players, you can give some of that to your assistant coaches, I think it just really can empower you to be able to develop and look at your overall program and be able to create one that is what you want. And a lot of times, like I said, that's hard to do in the moment. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. So when you think about big picture things that you've had success with everywhere you've been, if you had to point to one or two things that you feel like have been the key to your success at each of your stops, what would you say are those things that are kind of been your non-negotiables, things that, hey, we've been able to do this kind of everywhere we've been?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I was actually recently listening to a Hoopshead podcast you had with Nate Sanderson and talk about some of the different places he's been. I was like, man, I was like, getting my notebook out, writing things down for the next time if I ever take over a program again, because he had some great stuff to say.
Yeah, Nate's got a lot really good specific ideas.
Yeah, he's so good. And I think, you know, it was really also like, I would say almost lots of confirmation in what I heard him said. I think a lot of times as coaches, sometimes we don't even realize that we're doing a great job at certain things.
That's so
but
true.
We hear other successful coaches talk about what makes them successful and listen to Nate, like, it's like, oh, I did that. Oh yeah, we did that too. And it was just that yes, you know, like, you know, we as coaches so often we're on the right path, but just because the nature of our profession, it's almost like we're in silos. You know, Matt's at his school, Mike's at his school, Nate's at his school. And because we're like running our own race, a lot of times we don't understand, man, other guys are going through the same thing. And what I'm doing actually really is super successful, and being able to see that. And that's what I've really actually enjoyed this last year, not coaching a team, but going in to watch practices at the college level, the high school level, the middle school level, the pro level. You know, it doesn't matter what level it is, but just being able to go in and watching things that work. And I would say for me, as we've taken over, was it 5 or 6 different programs, and really each time had the cool opportunity to level them up, who we were as a team, the expectations of the program, and what might be possible moving forward. The two things that we always hung our hat on was, number one, culture. And, you know, part of me like even hesitates to say that word, because that is such a catchy word in our profession today. Is what's the culture bring? I mean, you watch this time of year when so many new head coaches are taking over, and you listen to their press conferences at the college level. Rarely do they not talk about culture. And so we know it's important, but even what does that mean? And so two things that we always want to do with our teams is, number one, is build an environment where they felt they had a safe space, you know, a safe space to make mistakes. We don't learn if we don't make mistakes. But I think a lot of times in practices, a player makes a mistake, and we as coaches, every mistake we're all over them about in a very negative way. And so we wanted to build an environment and a culture where, you know what, you knew you were cared about. And if you made a mistake, it was okay. You know, some mistakes were a lot easier to work through than others with players, and poor choices and things. But you know what? No matter what you did, we were going to be there with you and work through it with you. And the second thing that we want to do in our environment was build one of joy. You know, I love hearing Coach Drew talk about that Baylor during this last season, and just having a place where you want to come and have fun. I mean, I don't know about many, you know, professions where if you hate your job and it is just the biggest drag in the world to go there from 9 to 5, like, you're not going to last very long. And even hearing Nate talk about that when you guys are having your conversation, like, you know, last class period of the day, are our players excited about going to practice?
Right.
Or are they thinking of every reason not to show up? And so I think that's the environment that, you know, we'd always try to, again, like a safe space, one that's full of love and joy. And the third thing was going to be, it's going to be full of hard work. And that we really knew as coaches, if we could set the tone with, you know, turning over every rock when it comes to film and watching opponents and coming up with the best strategies and ideas and expecting that same effort from the players and practices. When we started to do those three or four things within the culture, things began to work themselves out along the process. And so that's one thing that we've always focused on. And as far as on the court going, I mentioned a little bit earlier, but for us, it was always so big. And that first meeting we had as a team is to talk about, listen, you might not be used to the style that we're going to play because we're going to play a faster pace than most teams. And we, you know, me personally, I am all in 100% committed to action-based offenses over sets and plays and running those things. And so we just let them know, hey, it's going to be a process and it's not going to look pretty at first. But if you give it a chance, you know, those first couple of weeks of scrimmages, even that first week or two of games, our turnover rate is probably gonna be a little high because we're playing faster than most of you are used to. Our, you know, shooting percentage will probably be a little lower because it's just different in those first couple of games than it is than what we can do in practices and those simulations. But if you give it a chance about that third week of the regular season, there's going to be a flip that's switched. And turnover rate goes down, shooting percentage goes up. You know, the frustrations begin to, you know, dissipate a little bit and the successes and the celebrations go up. And so really painting that vision from the start in the summer and let them know what's coming up ahead. You know, I've really the idea of an expert versus a novice is, I think, something we as coaches could do a better job of explaining to our players. And one thing that makes the expert so special is they know exactly what to look for. You know, if we're playing the piano, I've got a sister who's a phenomenal piano player. You never want to hear me on the keyboard, right? But as a novice, if I'm sitting down trying to play something, I'm trying to figure out every individual note. I'm looking all over the keyboard and trying to connect the dots between what I see and what I hear, what my fingers are doing. But she's an expert. She doesn't need all the information because she knows what she needs to look for. She needs to know exactly. She knows exactly in what's coming next, what's most important. And so that's what we try to do as a coaching staff. You know, first me with my staff, and then us as a staff with our players, and then even with our families and administration, everybody who's involved in that process is, hey, this is what our journey is going to look like. These are some of the roadblocks and the hiccups and construction zones that we'll hit along the way. But if we all will stay committed to this process, it's going to be really, really special at the end.
That communication up front, I think, is really important to be able to share with everybody who's a stakeholder in your program. You just mentioned administrators, parents, obviously the players. But you have to lay out what's going to be expected. And if you don't, a lot of times those voids get filled by unrealistic expectations where
yep, so true.
When you're talking about like a player who, if you don't communicate what their role is going to be and where you see them in the program, every kid's going to come into fall practice or the first game thinking, hey, I'm about to play 30 minutes in a 32-minute game. And parents are going to think the same thing, right? That if you don't communicate clearly where a player stands, that's oftentimes where the frustrations of players and parents come from, is that lack of communication, lack of understanding of where exactly you stand. So I think especially when you take over a brand new program, you have to come in and you have to make sure that people understand those expectations. So we've talked a little bit about coaches. We've talked a little bit about players. Let's talk a little bit about the parent side of it. In your experience as a high school head coach, what are some of the things that you've done to try to better engage parents to get them to become a part of your program in a positive way versus sort of the way we always hear about parents, which is, oh, they're a problem and they're wearing us out and they're complaining and this and that. So how do you try to get the parents on your side, for lack of a better way of saying it, and buying into what it is that you're trying to do with the program?
Yeah, no, there's one image that I always keep at the forefront of my mind's eye anytime I'm dealing with a parent. And, you know, early in my coaching career, anytime I was interacting with a parent, I kind of saw it as me sitting on one side of the desk or the table and them sitting on the other in an adversarial role. You know, like it's just that picture we always have in those meetings we have with parents, you know, after, hopefully not right after a game. Hopefully we're taking some time before we meet with somebody. But whether, you know, it's during our you know, our off period or, you know, whatever it is when we want to meet with a parent. And a couple of years into my coaching career, just kind of flipped that image into, you know what? Really what the parents want is what is best for their child. And what I want is also what I feel is best for their child. We just have two different lenses we're looking through. They're looking through only their child's lens. And as a coach, I'm looking through Jimmy's lens and Johnny's lens and everybody else's lens at the same time. And so kind of flip that picture in my head to, hey, you know what? We're actually sitting on the same side of the table, wanting what is best for the individual athlete. And but what I have to do is do a great job of communicating what, how that best fits the, you know, the athlete's needs, the athlete's wants, the athlete's desires, and with the whole scope and sequence of what we're doing as a team. And so I think a couple of things that I've done that have just been so helpful for me as a coach is, number one, I'm very transparent with the with the parents when we talk. Not transparent as far as, hey, come in and watch film, tell me what you think I should do, but just really being straightforward and honest with them. You know, hey, you know, if Johnny wants more playing time, I understand. I want Johnny to play more, right? I think as a coach, if we kind of help parents understand, like, you know, how much we care about or feel about your son or daughter is not measured by playing time. You know, we can care a lot about some players that maybe they just don't have the right skills to be there, or even maybe just the person in front of them is just better than them. And it's sometimes that's a hard thing to overcome and communicate. And so really, we would work hard to have those open, transparent conversations early in the process. I think, you know, my young coach, Matt, early in my coaching career, I would avoid parents at all costs early on, you know, just like, are they mad? Are they upset? I'm not sure, right, you know, and right. And then all of a sudden, the only time they would ever track me down was when things were bad. So the only time we ever had conversations is when they were frustrated, is when things weren't going their son or their daughter's way, the way they felt they should go. And so I think as coaches, a great thing we can do is start the conversation early and have times when we're around the parents. And let them know, you know, in our first meeting every year, whether it's the first year when we take over a program or the parent meeting we have every year leading up to a season, in that first meeting, we're telling the parents, hey, this is our system. This is our strategy. These are things that we're focused on this year. These are things that we believe are going to help make successful. This is how your son or your daughter can earn more playing time, and take them through. And I'll even say, hey, listen, I know a lot of you in this room are passionate about the game, have played it at high levels, and there are a lot of different ways to skin the cat as far as the game of basketball goes. You know, I don't, as a coach, I believe there's only one absolute in the game of basketball, and that is more points wins. Besides that, you know, there's so many different ways we can find ways to be successful and to win games, and just communicate with the parents, hey, this is the way that we feel is best as a coaching staff, and this is how you can help support your son or your daughter as we're going through the process. And then just making it very, very straightforward for them. You know, one thing that we found as coaches that we're great with these parent conversations, because for whatever reason, Mike, I don't know if you've experienced this, but so often it comes down to how many shots a certain person is getting. You know, we need more shots. When they say right. playing time, they really mean more shots, is what they mean. They want to see the ball go up in the air. And so, you know, one thing we did as a team was your freedom to let the ball fly during games was directly associated with how well you shot during practice. And so if a parent came to me frustrated about maybe the lack of opportunities for their son and for their daughter, my conversation was, well, have you checked the leaderboard? Because we gave our players access to our leaderboards through the things we different do in practice. I would love for Timmy to shoot more in the next game as well. Unfortunately, his averages and his scores just aren't there yet. And as soon as Timmy hits those scores, man, he's gonna be able to let it fly all that he wants to during a game. And so having those, you know, very, you know, so often as coaching, there's always gonna be a subjective part to coaching. But if we can clearly define when we do this, that will happen, I think that helps. You know, it's not going to take every parent quote problem or issue or concern away, but it's really just going to help set the table for us as coaches and how we have those conversations and how we can navigate those waters with parents.
Certainly having that quantitative data to back up or support your point, your subjective point as a coach, I think is always valuable. It's much better. It's just like being a parent, right? And you talked about it a little earlier as a coach. When you share the why with your players or your kids, you tend to get a much better response than because I said so.
Absolutely.
Because I said so might have worked well when I was a kid in the 70s, but I don't think it works quite as well now as it used to. So if you can have some data to back that up, that certainly is going to help. When you talk about that data, what are some things that you chart, and then what's your process for charting? Because I know one of the things that high school coaches sometimes struggle with is, hey, I've got my staff of whatever. Some coaches might only have one varsity assistant and maybe their JV practices at a different time. And so the idea of figuring out how do I chart stuff and still actually coach the practice, I think is something that coaches sometimes struggle with. So what's your process for what you chart and then how you actually physically go about charting it?
Yeah, no, for sure. That's a great question. And I think, you know, one, whatever it is, whether it's charting shots or whether it's whatever we're looking for as a coach, when it comes down to it, we have to figure out a way to make it work. You know, so often we tell players, hey, no excuses. It is what it is. Figure it out. I know you're only 5'5". If you want playing time, you got to be special at something. You're not 6'5" like your teammate is. So I think sometimes as coaches, at least for me, I would a lot of times really let things become excuses. You know, oh, we don't have the budget for this, or I don't have enough people on staff to do that. But really what I was communicating was I haven't found, if it really matters to me, I got to find a way to make it work. And so when it came down to things like that, like, yeah, even the last couple of years, you know, with COVID and how that's impact, you know, different situations and things, there was a time for a while where I was the only coach in practice, with our team that was full of seniors. We were expected great things and we couldn't lose our standard of tracking. And so what we've done throughout the years and what we will always do anytime I'm coaching a team, whether it's, again, just me or with a staff full of coaches and managers and assistants or whatever else. Number one is that earlier I mentioned we would have a 30-minute dedicated shooting segment in practice. And a big chunk of what that shooting segment would be sets of 10. Of, you know, every player, where they're shooting from might be a little different. We would tailor it to where they were getting most of their shots of in games. We wouldn't just say, hey, 50 catch and shoot threes, 10 from all five spots. We would actually know the data. What locations are we getting threes from most often as a team? Then specifically you as a player, what locations are you getting the most threes from? Or even do you shoot a higher percentage on one side of the floor versus the other? And is there enough data there that says, hey, we should get you on the right side more than the left and try to figure out where that sweet spot was. And then we would make sure our players were tracking that. And whether it was a scrap of paper and a pencil that was underneath the goal that they were writing it down and then would turn in at the end of practice. And then I would take into, you know, to my computer and put it in Google Sheets and just have it set up to track. Or maybe if we had, you know, a great manager one year or an extra assistant coach, maybe they were inputting that information in real time. But we were just making sure anything that we really valued, you know, because I think that's where a lot of things as coaches, like we want our players to, you know, if it comes to decision making, you know, we want the players to be okay, define it, plan it, measure it, like go for it. Well, are we doing that same thing in our practices? And so again, going back to shooting, we would define what our expectations were. For us, we had what we'd call our green light standard. And so we would have not only the sets of 10 that we were tracking, but, you know, similar to like Coach Neighbors at University of Arkansas on the women's side, he's got some great stuff on YouTube that you can find. But we would every year would pick out two or three shooting drills that had some kind of time to it and some kind of score attached to it. And then based upon what your average was, is what it would give you the freedom to shoot. Like one of my favorite shooting drills that we use, we called it Redick 94 shooting. So you had 4 minutes and 90 shots, whichever came first, and your time was up. And for us as a team, if you could average 45 makes or more in those 4 minutes, max of 90 shots, then you had the freedom to shoot any time that when you caught the ball, you were on balance, in range, in rhythm, right? Those three things, check, 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 let it fly. Even if you were 2 for 7, like let it fly. You are open and you've proven over the course of time what a great shooter you are. And then for us, we would also have, you know, the opportunity for players to level up. If we had a player who was averaging, you know, let's say 55 or more makes in that same drill, if they were 0 of 14, we were still drawing up plays for them, right? Like, because you've proven you're a great shooter over time. It's like Kobe Bryant said, shooting is math. If I'm a 50% shooter and I'm 0 for 4, that just means I'm gonna make 5 of my next 6. And so I think, you know, a lot of times it's easy for us as coaches to in the moment make adjustments when things don't feel like they're going well. But just like we always preach, you gotta trust the process. And so, yeah, we would track those things and at a minimum, right? Google Sheets is great. It's free. It's out there. We would input all of our information in that. We'd have different tabs for different shooting drills. And what was great, because then players could actually go back and see their averages over time. And then one thing that I found was an unintended benefit of going to the shooting system approach that we had where we tracked and we measured. You know, we made plans for it and we were always talking about scores. You know, I think a lot of times I talk to coaches and they get really frustrated at the end of practice. Like once practice is done, you know, practice is over, players are on their own, that a lot of frustration I hear, one of two things. Either players don't stay after practice, right? The moment it's 1, 2, 3 break, they are out of the gym as fast as possible. Or number two, it turns into like an attempted dunk contest on the guy's side or some kind of jelly roll layup contest.
Fake dunkers.
Yes, fake dunkers. I was there. I can't judge it. That was me at 17 as well.
But, I talk to my son about that all the time. I'm like, man, there's a lot of fake dunkers out here.
Yeah, that's true. And what we found is when we went to the shooting system approach, because you always had the freedom to shoot those same tests on your own and then report the score. And if you didn't like your score, don't report it. But if you like your score, report the coach, let know. And all of a sudden, players who would be really close to earning that freedom to shoot after practice, they were getting up more shots. They were getting with a teammate, you know, like if it's me and you have to practice, hey, Mike, if you'll rebound for me for the next 2 minutes, then I'll rebound for you for 2 minutes and let's see if we can improve our score. And then all of a sudden the players who had already earned the freedom to shoot saw their teammates were gunning for them. And so they would shoot more after practice. And it was this great, natural, healthy competition that all of a sudden it'd be 30, 40 minutes after practice. We still have five or six guys getting shots up, not because we told them to, but because they knew, hey, if I put in the work and my scores go up, I'm going to have the freedom to shoot in games. You know, it's not does coach like me or not. It's what do my scores say? What do my numbers say? And again, we can't do that for every single stat or every single thing a player can bring to the, you know, to the team on the floor. But shooting is definitely one thing that we can track and measure as coaches.
Well, you talked about it right off the top, right? You can do a whole bunch of things right. And if the ball doesn't go in the basket, not a whole lot else matters.
Absolutely. 100%.
You can have the greatest X's and O's in the world, and that ball still just sometimes won't go in the hole. I know I've had coaching my own kids over the years. I probably said this more than I did when I was a high school coach, but you know, because again, you're coaching kids when they're younger, and shooting percentages are a lot lower. But I can just imagine so many times that sitting next to my assistant coaches over the years, and just turning to them and go, the ball just doesn't go in. It just doesn't go in the basket. And you can do all these other things, but ultimately if you can't shoot, it's gonna kill you both as a player and as a coach. And to be able to inspire kids to want to get shots up on their own, and then like I said, to have that empirical data that you can then show to a player, that you can show to a parent, that you can use, again, it's not the be all end all, but it's just another thing that you can put in place to make sure that people understand of, hey, there's actual thought and reasoning behind the decision of who plays, who gets to shoot, and all those things. And I think it's interesting when you were talking about what it really comes down to is how many shots does my kid get? And I think one of the things that you learn as a parent sitting in the stands is you come to realize that in most cases, it's really interesting to hear parents and just listen to them talk. And no matter whether you have the parent of the star player or you have the parent of the 12th man, they can always find a reason to be unhappy if they want to be unhappy. Yep. And the star player's parent is unhappy because in the blowout, the star player gets taken out and doesn't get to play their normal amount of minutes. And so therefore doesn't get to score their normal amount of points, or they're only getting 15 shots a game, but they should be getting 20. And then you have the player 12 who just wants their kid to be on the floor for a minute during meaningful games, not just be able to play during blowouts. And it just runs the gamut through everybody. And I think that the lesson here for me, as I sit and listen to parents, and I think about it both from a coaching standpoint and a parent standpoint, is you just have to sit back as a parent and understand that it's the kid's journey ultimately. And if there is a disagreement with the coach, it should usually come from the player. Certainly first, it should come from the player, a discussion between the player and the coach first. And I think you said it best when you give your players opportunities to have those conversations, then chances are you've already had that difficult conversation with the player because those lines of communication are open. And I find, at least oftentimes, every once in a while you get a kid who's delusional, but for the most part, kids know, right? I mean, for the most part, if two kids are competing for the same position, the kid who doesn't get it most often, I think, understands that, hey, this guy's just, he's better than me. I'm going against him every day in practice. Now, they might not want to admit it, but I think when push comes to shove, they really know. More often, those problems come from parents pushing whatever it is. My friend Greg White, who's been on the podcast a bunch of times, head coach of a high school team in Arkansas, he says whenever he tries to deal with parents or thinks about having to figure out a way to be able to communicate better with parents. He says, I always just try to remember that every parent wants the lineup to be the four best players and their kid. And that's how every parent approaches it. I want the four best players on the floor and my son or my daughter. And if you think about it that way, it kind of just in your mind, it can kind of break the tension and kind of get you to understand that, hey, this parent, they're not necessarily coming at it from the most realistic perspective. And then you just try to figure out the best way to make sure that, again, you get them to buy into what you're trying to do and get them on your side. And then you can have the type of experience for both parents and players that you want to have as part of your program.
No, absolutely. And I agree 100% with what we said earlier. The more we can have consistent conversations, both with our players and the parents of our players, you know, the more that those other things just kind of can't take care of themselves in the end. Not that we, you know, don't care, laissez-faire, whatever happens, happens. But even recently I was on the phone with a former parent of a player of mine, and he had just finished up his freshman year at college, had gone to sign with a Division II school and had a full ride, but didn't quite have the playing time that he was hoping for. And again, the son, and the dad said this, but the son understood the lack of playing time a lot better than his dad did.
Right.
But then end of the season comes, and now with just the way that the college basketball works and the transfer portal and options and things, you know, the phone call to me was from the dad, like, well, should he transfer? What do you think he should do? And I was like, well, I don't have you. What does your son say? And so we, you know, had a conversation, and really what this dad said to me, which I think is as coaches, like, these are the relationships that we're looking for with the parents, because it's not just in the moment.
Right.
I think the best coaches are looking at what's our relationships to be like 5 years after your son or daughter stopped playing for me, you know, when they're going through a hard time in life, because that's where it's bigger than the X's and O's. And I know you and I are so much aligned on that. We want to win. We want to have great seasons whenever possible. But this is a long-term relationship. And so when we were having the conversation, he said, you know what, coach? He goes, I just want to thank you for never stopping talking to me. He's like, there were several times over the course of my son's high school career when I don't know if I would have talked to me anymore. And I just want to say, man, you know what? We're all passionate. You know, I mean, he played college basketball. He's actually also a college official. And so he knows the game. But just my style of coaching and the way that I approach offense and defense is different than what he would do. And so, yeah, we just had a great laugh over that in the conversation. And, you know, just, I was so thankful in that moment that I'd stayed true to who I knew I was supposed to be as a coach. I think early in my coaching career, I would begin to, you know, almost like chameleon-like, act different ways with different parents and try to, you know, say things in a certain way. So hopefully they understand, but they're not going to get mad at me at the end. Where, hey, we always want to speak the truth with love, but we got to keep speaking the truth to the parents that are there, are, you know, have these players from our programs back at home.
Yeah. Being able to have those honest conversations is critical. I think if you try to sugarcoat things and you try to tell people what they want to hear, you're just going to end up getting yourself in trouble, and you're going to make the future conversations even more difficult. It just makes sense to have the conversation up front, move on, and then everybody understands where everybody stands.
Yeah. It's like we think we're just sweeping things under the rug, but really what we're doing is creating a landslide that's going to come to a head at some point in time.
Exactly. And we can all think of those situations, I'm sure, in our personal lives, in our coaching lives, in our professional lives, where you made the mistake of, I'm just going to kind of weasel around this thing. And then it ends up being a lot worse in the end. And so you're much better off. I think as you get older, you come to realize that you got to say what you got to say. And the sooner you do that, the better off everybody is. All right, let's talk about your decision to step away from high school coaching and sort of this next phase of your coaching career, where you're getting into more coach consulting, you're getting into trying to have a bigger impact on the coaching profession. Just tell us a little bit about the journey to get there, what you thought about, why you made that decision, and then we can dive into some of the specific things that you're doing as a part of that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. You know, I had the awesome opportunity to be a high school head coach for 14 years, tons of successful seasons, loved everywhere that we had been, but also moved a lot. You know, I think early in my coaching career, I was like so many of us. And I would say there's however we want to approach our coaching journey, whether that's always move up to the next highest level, always be looking for the, like, I get it. I understand it. I'm not saying there's just one way, right? There's not just one way to coach the game, and there's not just one way to approach our coaching journey throughout the course of our career. But early on for me, it was always what's the next job that I can get, where every spring I was just hounding different, you know, state association boards, looking for job openings, applying for 30 jobs, seeing what was out there and going and going and going. And after about 7 or 8 years of just kind of chasing my tail, realized, hey, you know what? The grass is greener where you water it. And so when we were just outside of Houston, Texas, it was my fourth coaching spot I had been in 7 or 8 years as a head coach. We had moved a lot. We really decided, hey, we're gonna get here. We're gonna plant our feet. We're gonna just dig roots. It's gonna be great. And two great, super successful years. In fact, my second year there in the Houston area. You know, that year we went 32-8 during the season. Made it all the way to the Final Four. And if we don't have time for me to tell you a story, but if Disney made a movie of our loss in that game, nobody would believe it. It was one of those things where everything went wrong for us, and credit to them, everything went right. They hit the shots that we didn't, and it was an amazing victory for our opponent. But again, we were just two great seasons riding high, and actually we were going to lose every player who mattered off of that team just about. But I'd never been more excited as a coach to develop and to plan. And man, we have these eighth graders coming up, and it's going to be two tough years, but man, what can we do to get back here in 3 or 4 years to this point? And about a week and a half later, found out that I was no longer going to be the coach at the school anymore. And it was one of those shocking moments that I think we've all had. You know, I'll never forget when I was a teenager walking into the kitchen, happy, upbeat, excited. And then I see the look on my parents' faces and I'm like, ooh, what did I do this time? You know, like you just know that moment's right, happening. Yep. And so I had a similar one. You know, it was a couple of weeks outside the season, walked into the office of one of the people who were in charge of the school and found out we hadn't always seen eye to eye behind closed doors, but had always supported in public and in front and whatever. We all have our own reasons to do things, but found out I was not going to be back the next year as the coach. And that was really tough for me. Actually, went through, you know, I grew up in the Southeast, like we talked about, North Carolina, and I don't know if anybody intentionally ever taught me this, but was definitely, you know, something that I learned at an early age, or at least thought I was supposed to learn, was that, hey, as a guy, you don't show emotions. If, you know, if you have anything that's frustrating or you're upset about, swallow it, bury it, you know, be tough. And we do need more toughness in our world today, but I also think emotions are real. And for the first time in my life, I mean, I went through a 4-month stretch where every single job I applied for, I was denied. Like, you know, as coaches, once you're around long enough, you know those jobs you should definitely get.
Right.
I was applying for every job. Because even at the time, you know, my wife and I had 4 kids and I'm thinking, I got to feed them. I got to take care of, like, what are we going to do? Even that one tough day when I found out I wasn't coming back, I'll never forget. I was sitting outside. My wife was sitting with me. We're on the, just sitting outside in the grass and hadn't gone in to tell the kids yet. And our neighbor comes across from across the street, could tell I've had a bad day, and puts his hand on his shoulder. He goes, rough day, Matt? I was like, yeah, man, you have no idea. He goes, hey, it could be worse. You could have been fired. And all of a sudden, just the look on my face, he was like, oh my goodness, right? Because I started crying and upset. And, you know, again, then go through this next 4-month stretch where I'm not getting jobs, and really, you know, on a personal level, began to deal with anxiety and depression in ways that I'd never experienced before. And so, you know, ended up going to Cassidy High School in Oklahoma City and had a great 4 years there. And the reason I kind of built all the way up to answer your very simple question about stepping away is at the end of the 2020-21 season, just realized there were some changes happening at the school. They were deciding to kind of go in a different direction with athletics. And I was looking for maybe what's next. For me, just in my own life, I have an incredible wife. I married way, way up. I don't know whatever did to convince her to marry me. And she had just started her own business and it was exploding. And I was like, you know what? Maybe it's a good time for me to take a step back. And because once I went through what I went through with losing a job and dealing with the anxiety of not being able to find a job and being passed over and all those things, as I began to share that story with other coaches, I learned how many coaches went through the same thing. Kind of like talking about earlier when I was listening to Nate and you have a conversation like, oh yeah, I was doing those things too. But the same, even the bad side, you know, or the frustrating side is the same. So many coaches lose a job that they care about that's outside of their control. So many coaches have anxiety. So many coaches, you know, are doing everything they can to be successful and just don't have the support from, you know, all the stakeholders like we were talking about earlier. And so at the end of that 2020-21 season, just felt like it was a great time for me to not just impact the 12 or 15 guys on my varsity team or the 35, 40 guys in my high school program, but in this new stage of life, how can I help journey with and support coaches, players, and parents, you know, all across the country, all across the world, who are going through similar things, and help them just find ways to level up, right? They want to get from point A to point B, but they're not really sure the steps in between. And so now I've had the cool opportunity to start this journey where I'm helping, like I said, coaches, players, and parents, not only define what's next, but come up with a plan of how to get there for what they want out of the game of basketball.
So what does that look like on the ground? What are some things that you're doing to impact those people directly? How are you getting in touch with them? Just explain exactly what it is that you do.
No, for sure. You know, number one, it's really important to me to serve and provide great resources at no cost. You know, obviously I have some things I do that you know, have a cost attached to it, but I want to provide incredible value for everyone and anyone. And so really simple, kind of got on the computer one day and went to Wix.com and started my own website. And so it's CoachMcLeod.com. And on the website, I have, you know, video breakdowns and film breakdowns of, you know, whether it's team concepts or actions or skills. Also have a weekly newsletter that goes out to players, coaches, and parents. It's called The Deep Three. And I also have my coach's newsletter, the Coach's Corner, that goes out every week, every other week with thoughts and ideas specifically for coaches. And so just trying to provide that value through, like I said, film breakdowns, through newsletters, through analyzing what's going on in the game of basketball today. Also have a blog that I write that's there on my website. That really, again, like I said, trying to provide great value. And then on top of that, finding ways where I can connect with coaches, and I do one-on-one coaching with coaches, one-on-one coaching with players, whether that's on the court or off the court, helping them walk through the college recruitment process. You already talked about that earlier. It's a lot different now than it was 15 or 20 years ago. And really just helping coaches, players, parents navigate these waters. Also do some, you know, small group, like cohort type coaching with coaches. During the season, we did a way to focus on skill development in season, because I think that's one thing a lot of coaches are looking for, but we don't always quite know how to do. And so just finding ways like that, like I said, where I can bring value and help coaches, players, parents, wherever they're at, get to wherever they want to go to with the game of basketball.
What's been the value to you on a personal level from going through this? Because when I hear about this, one of the things that I think the podcast has done for me is it's exposed me to so many great basketball minds, so many different ways of approaching the game and thinking about it, that it's got me to go back and self-analyze, like we talked about earlier, and figure out, hey, what is it that I'm doing that I can do better? And even in my day-to-day teaching job, there's things that I've learned from people that we've had on the podcast that I've been able to take back and use to be able to impact what I do day to day. So when you think about, yeah, you're having an impact on others, but what have you learned for yourself through this process? Maybe it's just in terms of solidifying and kind of bringing everything together into one place, or just talk a little bit about what you've gained from this process.
Oh, man. I've gained so much, you know, through this process. Number one is really just realizing the importance as a coach to not just having what you do, but having what you do written down. You know, what is our system? What is our approach? Like things that, you know, I think a lot of us as coaches, you know, are, we all want to develop, like we talked about earlier. Sometimes we don't know how to, in season, out of season, there might be more options. But, you know, my first handful of years as a coach, my development plan was go to YouTube and watch videos, get on every newsletter possible and read them as much as I could and highlight and print off and save. But it didn't have a plan for me to follow. You know, it was just kind of whatever fell in my lap, whatever rabbit hole I got down through on YouTube to try to learn something new. And so it's really taught me the importance of making sure that, like, hey, as a coach, like, I know not only what's important and where I want to go, but like, what are we gonna do in between? So, like, meeting one of the coaches I'm working with right now, he's a high school girls coach in Minnesota, and came on as a consultant with them at the end of the current season. And so I was watching a little bit of film and kind of asking what he was thinking about his team and where he'd like to go. And one thing he said, I was like, man, I wish we were better decision makers. Like, I like the stuff that we run, but if we can make better decisions, I was like, okay, well, how are you gonna make better decisions? And it was kind of quiet there for a second. You know, it's like, ooh, I hadn't thought about that. And we all have that as coaches, right? Like, we're so in the weeds of it all that we might miss out on opportunities. And so it's, you know, he and I then kind of over the next 6 weeks came up with what is his off-season plan going to look like and how is he going to implement it for his players? And that's something I wish I had done a better job of as a coach myself is, hey, first off-season, this is the end in mind, which I think I did a pretty good job of. But what I missed was the in-between. If it's going to look like this in October, November, and let's say we're having this meeting on June 1st. Well, this is what it needs to look like by September. And if it's like that in September, this is what it needs to look like by August 1st. And really kind of stealing from football coaches in that regard, where you have the end result in mind, that Friday night game. It's Friday, if we're going to be ready, Thursday has to look like this. If Thursday doesn't look like that, Wednesday's practice has to look like this. And building from the end back to the beginning versus starting where I am and hoping I get to where I want to go.
What's been the most fun part of the non-basketball side of this in terms of maybe the business part of it, whether it's just building the website or doing the marketing or just the things that it takes in order to kind of get this off the ground that are non-basketball related? Has there been any part of that that's been maybe more fun than what you expected?
I think the fun, I'm sure you've had a similar experience with what you've been doing. Like there are so many times I have like, just, I am convinced I have the world's best idea. Like this is going to be so good. Yep. Every person is not only going to click on like the title to my email. So good. Everyone's going to open it 100% open rate. And the quality of the content is so good. They're all going to sign up for it right away.
Absolutely.
And then it's crickets, right? Yep. Like, yep. Oh, yep. Only a third of the people I sent it to, like even what my best friend didn't open this, right? Cause we can get really in the details and the weeds or the analytics of even emails and who's opening it.
Yep.
So that's been one thing, like, man, just like in coaching, sometimes we think we have the best idea, the best game plan, but if we're 3 minutes in that game and it's not working, it's time to do something different. And so that's been a lot of fun for me. That's always was my approach to coaching. You know what? We're going to try it. And if it doesn't work, no worries. We'll do something different the next time. We'll figure it out. And so I've had a lot of fun just failing and seeing what doesn't work. And then, you know, how it goes every once in a while, something that I didn't think was going to be that big of an idea or something that I didn't really think was going to have a ton of value. Getting the testimonials back and getting the emails and the texts and the direct messages of the impact that that little tiny thing, what I felt was tiny, the major impact it had on others. And so that's been a lot of fun as well.
That's so true when it comes to trying to figure out what people might click on, what people might want, what programs that you can put together, people are going to want to be a part of. It's always interesting, and we've had some different iterations of things we've done. And I think we always try to experiment with social media and try to figure out what works and what are people going to want to click on and how can we grow our followers? How can we grow the listenership? And it's always, I tell people, it's just, you're just throwing things at the wall and trying to see what sticks. And so you just keep trying different things. And that's part of the fun of developing, whether it's a podcast or a website or a coaching consultancy or whatever it might be. You're just trying to figure out what it is that is going to work. And a lot of times I think there's a tremendous amount of value that you can provide. It's just a matter of how do you unlock that through marketing or through the right plan to be able to get it to the right people. And I think that's the challenge. And coaching is a lot like that, where you have this vision of what you want to do. You have these different parts, the players, you have your assistant coaches, you have the greater school community. And you had all these different things that are kind of playing into whether or not you can have success. And then it's up to you to kind of mix and match and put those parts together and really figure out what it's going to be and what it's going to work and how you can unlock the things that you want to bring to the table that you can share, the value that you can bring to other people. And that's the challenge. That's the fun. And the nice part about it, whether you're podcasting, you're coaching, you're working with a team, you're working with other coaches, whatever it might be, I think the most fun and gratifying part of that is all through it, you get the chance to build relationships with really good people who are trying to do good things. And in our case, doing great things through the game of basketball, which is a game that we all love. Mm-hmm. And that's something that to be able to do that for me with a game that's been as great to me as the game of basketball has been, whatever little I'm giving back through this podcast just makes it so that I feel like that all the game has given to me, that in some small way, I'm able to connect with people who have that same feeling, get the same joy from the game as I do, and hopefully share that so that we can continue to impact the game and just make it better for coaches, for players, for everybody who's involved in it. And that to me is really what it's all about.
Oh man, so true. And even, you know, one of the things I'm doing right now as well is going and doing, you know, team clinics and working on the ground with whether it's the coaching staff or running practices or doing some of the off-season development. And for me, it's been just I love seeing those light bulbs turn on for players. Last weekend, I was in North Carolina working with a middle school group, and just some of these girls that they don't know what they don't know. We talked about that before with us as coaches, but players are the same way. And just seeing the light come on for the first time, we were actually just running a very simple split action off the ball. And I think we went the first, 10 minutes without even getting an open look off of it. But just staying with it, all of a sudden something clicked, and even though the defense knew it was coming, the girls got 9 straight layups out of split action. And all of a sudden, now it's split action is the best thing in the world that we've ever done. And while there's a lot of ways to do it, it was just seeing those wins. Because I think, you talked about your kids, and I've got 4 kids myself, and just seeing them be successful at what they care about, that brings so much joy to me as a dad. I want them to fail. I want them to fall off the bike. I want them to have overcome adversity. But when they can find that click and they level up, man, I get so excited. And so that's what I love about what I get to do right now is, whether it's the coaches I work with, whether it's the teams I go in and train, whether it's the parents that I meet with and talk through about how to be a better sports parent, just seeing those light bulbs come on. And, again, it's not just me. It's not that I'm the smartest person in the room. I've just been able to be in rooms with lots of smart people over the course of my life. Basketball has been really, really good to me, like it's been to you. And so being able to take the things that I've learned as the dumbest person in the room, but just pass that knowledge forward, man, I didn't think that I could love something as much as I love coaching, the games and the strategy. But this last year has been a lot of fun, and I'm having, just really enjoying what I get to do now.
All right. So I don't want to throw rain on your parade here, but my next question is, when you look forward and you look ahead 3 to 5 years out, where do you see yourself, or what's the future hold for you as a coach? For just where do you see yourself in three to five years? What's the plan?
That's a really, really good question. That's one I ask myself almost every day when I wake up. Okay. What am I doing today? Is this going to be what I want to do in 3 to 5 years? Is this taking me down that path? 12 months ago, I'd have told you I definitely will get back into coaching at some point in time. And maybe I do. I've got 4 kids. Like I said, 2 sons who, whatever sports and seasons their favorite sport right now, they're 5th grade and 2nd grade. So they got a long ways to go. But we're already navigating those waters with my 5th grade son. Hey, man, do you want me to coach you in high school? And his answer was, I don't know. That might be kind of weird. I was like, yeah, I kind of feel the same way. And so we'll navigate as it comes to it. Coaching at the college level is something that I have always had a desire to do, and some opportunities here and there. But man, that lifestyle is very tough on the families. You and I both sure have friends. I've got lots of great friends. I know you do too, that will have 4 or 5 great years and then one below average year, and all of a sudden they're looking for a new house. Yep. They're looking for a new job. Yep. And so those are the things that we're balancing out. But I would say 3 to 5 years from now, I want to be doing what I'm doing right now. I want to be finding ways on a daily basis to impact the people that I get to come in contact with. And if that's still going to be through a newsletter and through YouTube videos and through going in and running practices and consulting, hey, awesome. If that's, working at the professional level, whether it's in player development or working, on a staff somewhere, hey, great. If it's going and taking over a tiny class A high school somewhere that's got 30 total high school students, hey, let's go there and do the best job that we can with that situation that we're given. But man, I love what I'm doing right now, and just want to keep finding ways in the next 3 to 5 years to be impacting the game in a positive way and impacting the people who care about this game that guys like you and I love so much.
That's well said. I'm glad you didn't throw that question back at me and ask me. So,
hey, next time, I get to turn the microphone on you next
right,
time
when you start we'll when you start out. Your podcast, that's gonna be your next thing. So when you start that, you can have me on as a guest. All right, before we finish up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can reach out to you, connect with you, share your website again, tell them how they can subscribe to the newsletter, social media, whatever you want to share, and then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Sounds great. Yeah, Mike, I appreciate it. The website is www.coachmcleod.com. My last name is spelled M-C-L-E-O-D. So coachmcleod.com is where the website is. People, they can sign up for the newsletter right there. Also, one thing that I love doing is I do complimentary 20-minute consultations with players, coaches, whoever wants it. And so right there, when you go to the homepage of the website, it says Get Connected. When you click on that, you have the opportunity to just go straight to my calendar and book a 20-minute phone call, or I'm sorry, 20-minute Zoom call, where we'll just talk about what's going on in the game of basketball for you and maybe some ideas, some thoughts I had that might be able to help you out with whatever going on as a player or coach. Love interacting on social media. Same handle on both Twitter and Instagram. It's just underscore Matt McLeod. So underscore MattMcleod. Love interacting with coaches on Twitter. Like, Mike, I don't think I appreciated enough when I was coaching in high school the value of the things that are on Twitter for us as coaches. And so even now, just stepping back and having a little more free time to dive deeper into that social media platform, there is such great content out there, and love to interact with others who are on Twitter and looking to level up as a coach and help me get better in the things that I'm doing in life.
It is so easy to find stuff on Twitter, and it is amazing that if you take the time to go through the value of things that people are sharing, if you can tune out all the goofiness that's on there and really focus in on what the good stuff is, there's a ton of coaching resources. And there's so many people, and this is one of the things that has been really gratifying about the podcast, and I think it's just a part of the way coaches are today, there's so many people that are willing to share. And that's what makes the coaching profession so great, is just whether it's on Twitter, whether it's through podcasts, whether it's doing something like you, somebody offering, hey, here's 20 minutes of my time to kind of get on. Let's just talk through this. And it's amazing that you can connect with coaches all over the country through all these different ways. And it's something that when you go back again, 20, 30 years, it was impossible. It was impossible. And you know, so many guys, I think, you know, you mentioned about being in a silo earlier, that, you know, there was so often where 20 or 30 years ago, a coach, you didn't have anybody to turn to. Like, your coaches that you were coaching against that were in your area, they were all your rivals. You didn't really want to sit down and talk shop with them because you're going to play them probably. And now you can just, I mean, you can be here in Ohio and you can have a friendship with a coach in California. You can call them up and talk all you want because you know you're never going to play them. And people are just so willing to share. And that's what's been really, you know, just a great part of the coaching profession, and certainly a great part of the podcast. And I'm sure, you know, a great piece of what you're trying to do. So again, Matt, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. It's been a lot of fun having the conversation. We look forward to staying in touch and just continuing to be able to share the game. And again, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. So thank you. And to everyone out there, we appreciate you listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.